Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York has become ground zero in the battle over immigration under President Trump's aggressive deportation agenda. Jen Yun Han of the New York Public News Network speaks with the New York Immigration Coalition about how the state is pushing back and what the proposed New York for All Act could mean for immigrant communities. Plus, we'll check in with Liam Mayo of the River Reporter about that ICE raid last week at a local pizzeria in Honesdale. The owners are responding. How does a nearly forgotten Catskills village become a national destination for book lovers? We'll find out in the latest episode of Cat's Cast. Plus, changes on the horizon for Sullivan County's trail system, including updates on a major bridge project and a new countrywide, countywide hike. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Health officials in Gaza and the International Committee of the Red Cross say 27 Palestinians have been killed in the enclave today and dozens injured by the Israeli military. Palestinians were trying to get food delivered by a private U.S.-backed contractor in Gaza. NPR's Hadil Al-Shelchi reports disorder has continued around delivery of the food as aid organizations warn Gaza is close to famine.
It was another day of chaos and confusion as thousands of Palestinians tried to receive food from a site delivering supplies in the south of Gaza. Witnesses who were approaching the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, site said the Israeli military shot into the crowd. The Israeli military said that it initially fired warning shots to disperse a crowd that had gotten too close to troops and then directed fire near individuals who continued to approach them. The military said it was aware of casualties and was investigating. GHF insisted there was no shooting in its facility and said the incident took place beyond their, quote, secure distribution site. The United Nations said that aid distribution has become a, quote, death trap. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The suspect in Sunday's fiery attack on peaceful marchers in Boulder who were walking to support Israeli hostages in Gaza is expected to return to a courtroom on Thursday. He'll face local charges. They include 16 counts of attempted murder. The suspect also faces one charge of federal hate crime offenses. Stocks open mixed today as international forecasters warned of slower economic growth. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 80 points in early trading.
A new forecast from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development projects the U.S. economy will grow just 1.6% this year, down from 2.8% last year. The OECD says President Trump's trade war is also weighing on global growth. Economic worry has been very good for Dollar General as anxious customers go hunting for bargains at the discount retailer. Dollar General's most recent quarterly sales hit a record, topping $10 billion. The chain reported better-than-expected quarterly profits and raised its earnings forecast for the full year. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, up in Hong Kong and Shanghai, but down in Tokyo. Seoul's stock market was closed for the South Korean election. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says a runway at the troubled Newark Liberty International Airport has reopened. The New Jersey airport has experienced flight delays, and air traffic controllers have had brief but alarming equipment failures. At a news conference Monday, Duffy said workers quickly completed necessary repairs.
Today we're celebrating the opening of Newark's runway. And this is a 60-day project that actually is completed 13 days early.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 40 points. You're listening to NPR. Ukrainian officials claim they've attacked a major bridge in the occupied region of Crimea. They say they used underwater explosives to damage the span. It carries Russian military equipment to Russian soldiers fighting Ukraine. This is the third time, Ukraine said, it hit the bridge. One of a pair of famous eaglets living in the mountains of Los Angeles, east of Los Angeles, has left its nest for the first time. From member station KVCR, Madison Aument reports tens of thousands of viewers tuned in.
Sunny and Gizmo, who hatched in March, have become internet celebrities like their parents Jackie and Shadow. The pair of eaglets, believed to be females, were perched on a branch when Sunny flapped away. Sandy Steers, who operates the live stream, says it's a bittersweet moment.
She flew from the nest, and that gives her a much higher chance of success in life. And But at the same time, it means we won't see her as much.
Steer says the duo has been practicing for weeks by jumping and flapping their wings. She says eagles can fledge between 10 and 14 weeks, and says Gizmo, who's several days younger, could fly soon too. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ament.
News reports say the acting head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency told FEMA staffers he didn't know that there was an Atlantic hurricane season. The Department of Homeland Security, which oversees FEMA, says Acting Chief David Richardson was joking. DHS says the agency is ready to respond to disasters and protect Americans. The Atlantic hurricane season started last Sunday. The season will run through the end of November. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. New York State and its cities have been at the center of President Donald Trump's efforts to launch his mass-scale deportations of immigrants. Junyoung Han of the New York Public News Network sat down with Mirad Ouada, president of the New York Immigration Coalition, to talk about how the fight over immigration rights has played out in the state and about the New York for All Act, which would respond to recent developments.
Let's just start off first thinking at the national level. Before Donald Trump became president, he had promised the, quote, largest deportation in U.S. history. Now that he's been president, how has that been playing out at a national level and then to New York, where you and the organization do a lot of work?
Well, what we've seen is Donald Trump weaponize every federal law enforcement agency to be part of his mass deportation and family separation agenda. He is going after individuals like student activists and stripping away their status. You know, when he ran for office, he said that he was going to go after those who are, quote unquote, the most violent individuals. And what we are seeing is that he is not. And he is targeting mothers, nursing mothers here in Watertown, New York, where Border Patrol picked up a mother who just had recently a baby and detained her for deportation. And I can keep going on and on of these stories about how the Trump administration continues to weaponize the moment that we're living in. But what we need to really focus on is what the state of New York needs to do to protect all New Yorkers.
So several cities in the state have sanctuary city policies. It broadly allows the city to not interact or cooperate with federal government when it comes to immigration enforcement. So Rochester is my home station that I report for. That city has a sanctuary city policy, and so does New York City. From your vantage point, how well do you think this system is working?
So I think the sanctuary policies that are currently in place right now at the local level are doing what they need to do. For instance, in Rochester, it prohibits the use of local PD from becoming deputized immigration enforcement officers and colluding with ICE without a judicial warrant. And, you know, to see the attacks that we've been seeing on sanctuary policy is kind of comical when people are talking about how do we enhance public safety. Sanctuary policies are public safety measures. They encourage people to participate within our society so that they're able and comfortable enough to report things that are happening. And without them, a lot of people won't do that because they are fearful, and rightfully fearful, especially in the world that we're living in today, that they may end up entrapped in this dragnet of ICE enforcement that's happening.
There's been a push at the state level to implement a law that across the state would provide protections so that local and state enforcement would not have to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement agencies. Can you tell us a little bit about what that law is, what it would do more specifically, and what the movement is behind that right now?
Absolutely. The New York for All Act is a bill that would pretty much tell all state agencies and agencies that receive funding from the state that you need to stay focused on what your job is. If you are the local police department in Rochester, your job is to keep Rochester safe. It's not to deputize yourself as a federal agent. It is not for you to separate families. It is not for you to participate in this mass deportation agenda that Donald Trump has. It stops most collusion with ICE and Border Patrol unless there's a judicial warrant. And, you know, we already have an executive order from 2018 which prohibits the state police and state agencies from colluding with immigration enforcement without a judicial warrant. And if there were a judicial warrant, the state has been working with the federal agencies. We want to take that and make it across the board and not just within, you know, the state troopers, but also with local PD. When we separate families, we are gutting our communities and harming our local economy. And that in itself should be a real red flag for individuals. And that's not what we should be using our state dollars on.
That was Murata Walda, president of the New York Immigration Coalition. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Jun Young Han from the New York Public News Network. Now, across the river here in the Upper Delaware in Honesdale, Pennsylvania, last week, ICE agents from the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement visited Elegante Restaurant and Pizzeria on Main Street, and three employees were detained. Liam Mayo from the River Reporter was reporting on it and has an update from the owners of the restaurant and their response. Liam joins us live now. Good morning, Liam.
Good morning, Tim.
And so the again, just a little synopsis there, that there was an ICE raid in Honesdale last week. On Thursday, I believe it was, at Elegante Restaurant and Pizzeria. It's the second time that that's happened at that same location. The restaurant owners issued a statement on Friday. What did they say?
Yeah, so they said a couple of things. They said that both in the previous instance that you mentioned, as well as this most recent raid, all of the members who were taken by ICE to the restaurant's knowledge had legal asylum status in the United States. They said that the previously taken employee was released after immigration officials confirmed their legal status, and they remain hopeful that the same process will lead to the release of the three members who were detained in this most recent raid. But they also sort of asked for respect and understanding from the community. They said, quote, "These employees are not just staff. They are hardworking, dedicated individuals who are like family to us. We are deeply saddened by the way people can be judged based solely on appearance or where they come from rather than who they are and how they live their lives." And at least early indications are that the community has responded sort of with a lot of support for Elegantes. The day after the raid, they had sort of a very busy day and sort of released another statement saying that they appreciated all of the support they were seeing from the community.
So the community is stepping up there. I want to ask you a little bit more about community response, but also back to the statement from Sam and Tony Ann, the Elegante Restaurant and Pizzeria owners there. They also said that they are hoping that due process will bring clarity and fairness to the situation. What was your response when you first saw their statement, really?
Yeah, I mean, I was glad to hear some of the things they were, or glad to have confirmed some of the things they were saying about the individual's asylum status. That was something we had heard previously, but weren't able to confirm. And obviously, it's sort of to be determined whether this process will lead to the release of the individuals who were taken in the most recent raid. The restaurant owners do say also, well, if it's determined that these individuals are not legally permitted to remain in the United States, we understand that the law must be upheld. However, given sort of the fact they say where the previously detained team member was determined to be in the United States legally and then released, yet sort of was taken anyways, despite that legal status, it seems likely that the same could be true of, or is likely true of, these most recent detainees, that they have legal asylum status in the U.S. and that ICE sort of has detained them regardless of that status.
They also said they are, quote, "doing our best to continue daily operations while supporting our team and cooperating with the authorities." Where are we in this process? Is it still too early to say, or have you heard from authorities? What's the latest there?
It's still too early to say there, and just based on sort of the way they've operated across the country, as well as the way it played out the last time they came to Honesdale, it's kind of unlikely that we will hear more about this from authorities in the near future or at all, really.
You mentioned the Honesdale community responding with support of the restaurant. Has there been other response? I saw that the mayor of Honesdale posted a kind of a thoughtful post on Facebook as well.
Yeah, the mayor had a statement out about the situation, calling sort of for people to sort of listen to their local community values. He said that, you know, we should invite other levels of government to accept local values when they visit our community. Quote, perhaps some of these values are to not intimidate, do not frighten, do not traumatize, do not disrupt traffic, do not harm the downtown economy, to not obscure governmental activities, to share authorizing paperwork, to drive vehicles with government plates, and to be identifiable as representatives of the state when performing official duties. So basically saying that the way ICE agents conducted themselves and the other agencies who were present at the scene conducted themselves was against these local values. And he tied it a little bit to challenges against federal mask mandates from a couple of years ago, saying that, like, people around here don't like being told what to do, and that, and sort of making a connection between the pushback that people had to being told to wear a mask to the pushback to sort of masked, unidentified federal agents coming into a local community and doing basically as they please. He also said that a reasonable sort of way to push back against this would be just to sort of have compassion for the community. And that's been, you know, sort of a talking point throughout, is that, you know, there's not a ton you can do to challenge this in the middle of it as it's happening. But what you can do is in the aftermath, when you can reach out to your neighbors, you can support your neighbors, you can see these people as neighbors and not as sort of faceless victims of this kind of federal action.
Yeah, I mean, I read this statement on Facebook. I found it to be a thoughtful, moving statement. And have you noticed any changes in how local businesses or residents are talking about immigration enforcement since this event, and also since this plea from the mayor?
I haven't really been in touch with the community, or hearing what they've been saying since all this has happened. But the general. In general, I think there's been a lot of reflection about this and how it can happen here. I think it's one thing to see the work being done by ICE agents in the national news and to hear about it being done in communities across the country. And it is another thing entirely to see it happen to the place where you know, had your birthday party 5 years ago, or where you go to get pizza on a Friday night. So I think there's been a bit of a reckoning, and there's been a lot of reflection from the community about this, and just sort of the feeling that it has happened here.
One last thing before we take a quick break here. Have you heard from any of the employees, family members, coworkers, friends, anybody that related to those folks, or are they staying quiet?
I haven't heard anything beyond the sort of general statement that the restaurant put out.
Okay. Let's take a quick break here. Leah Mayo from the River Reporter. We'll come back and talk about what's coming up in the issue out tomorrow. Reporting on the Lackawaxen River and the tension between public access advocates and private landowners. More with Leah Mayo from the River Reporter after this. It's Radio Chatskill.
I'm Bill Williams. Join me tonight for the Kingfisher Project. My guests will be Jody D'Agostini and Andy Williams of the prevention and recovery organization, Community in Crisis.
I look at it as, I know my big motivator is, because I didn't have it directly in my family, but I, you know, one-offs all over the place. I didn't want to lose any more of our children.
That's the Kingfisher Project. Tonight at 6 on the local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeffersonville Bake Shop, open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, and after-school snacks. Also featuring olive oil, ceramics, and other handmade items by artists and makers in Palestine.
Radio Catskill brings the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to life. We cover local stories, alert you to important information, and share cultural programming to keep local traditions alive. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org and safeguard public media's future.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we are continuing our conversation with Liam Mayo of The River Reporter. The latest edition of The River Reporter is out on newsstands tomorrow and at riverreporter.com. And Liam has a story about the Lackawaxen River and some push for public access. Let's talk a little bit about this, the reporting. It's a multi-part series.
Yeah. So the Lackawaxen River is this river that runs both through Wayne and Pike counties and eventually meets the Delaware River. And in the recent years, there's been a lot of energy to open up public river access points along that river. There's a couple now opened in the past couple of years. There was one in White Mills, Pennsylvania, that opened up in October 23. Sycamore Point Park in Honesdale opened up this past year. There's another planned for Indian Orchard along Route 6 between Honesdale and Hawley. So they're just, as well as another access that's kind of being developed by the Lackawaxen Township, which is a township in Pike County, Pennsylvania, along the Lackawaxen River, sharing the name. It's not sort of the municipal body for the Lackawaxen River or anything. It's just the similarity of the names. But there's another access that township is proposing for its citizens along the river. So there's been a lot happening recently, but a lot of this energy dates back sort of years or even decades. There's been talk just in the Wayne County, Pike County community about how to open up the river to public use, public access for a long time. There was a group that sort of organized loosely as the Wayne Pike Trails and Waterways Alliance around 2017. Which sort of grew today into what's the Lackawaxen River Trails group. And they created, first in Wayne County, then in Pike County, a set of trail feasibility studies talking about how they could do sort of public trails along the Lackawaxen River. There's this sort of broad plan in place for a trail that would parallel the railroad tracks connecting Honesdale and Hawley and potentially beyond, sort of like a rail trail, except instead of turning the rails into trails, it would parallel the existing railroad ties as those are kind of still in active use. That trail project is still kind of ongoing, but as that sort of bigger project moved a little bit more into the background, the energy from the group focused on creating individual points for public access to the Lackawaxen River, which didn't exist really before they started getting involved. We have a quote from Grant Genslinger, one of the founding members of the group, saying that the Lackawaxen River, until we got involved, had no public accesses in Wayne or Pike counties directly to the river. So, so if you live in Wayne or Pike counties and you've put your kayak in at a public access point along the Lackawaxen River within the past couple of years, these are probably the people you have to thank.
And there are some people, though, pushing back, though, some concerns that landowners have along the river. What are they saying about increased public access?
Yeah, landowners have been saying, sort of in response to individual projects, they've just been pushing back a little bit against individual projects. When the trail study was done in Pike County, the study sort of concluded that, yeah, we could create this railroad trail along the railroad in Pike County, but we don't recommend doing that at this time because there isn't the public support for it, which at least personally that felt interesting. Just because it's rare that the government looks at something and then decides not to do it because of public opinion. It feels like that's sort of a not exactly the most common result of something like that. We talked with the Lackawaxen Township Supervisor Mike Mancino about some of this pushback, and he said that basically people were concerned about stuff happening in their backyards. The railroad tracks run through basically just people's property. So they, while there is the sort of the right of way, along the railroad tracks where legally you could put a trail, just without sort of infringing on these people's properties, that still brings a lot of visitors, a lot of like public access right into like the backyards of people's homes where there had not previously been any. So that was kind of some of the opposition to it. One of the things he's told us was that, like, say a homeowner might have a beautiful spot along the river, raising a family, feeling free to let their young children run down to the river, and that, quote, now suddenly that railroad track in your backyard is a hiking trail. So there was some understandable pushback to the idea of sort of that broad hiking trail. But there's also been a little bit of pushback to access to the river as well. Basically, by the fact that there hasn't been this public access to the river, a lot of the landowners along the river sort of see the river as private property. And they see, well, if you want to get out onto the river, you need to go and sort of buy private property along the river and become a landowner yourself to have access to the river. And there have been issues with people sort of getting in at a river access point upstream of people's properties. And then because you can't go back upstream to the same river access point where you got in the river after you've floated downstream. So people have been known to get out at people's private property once they've floated down the river and sort of caused some issues there.
Right. And so there's definitely some tension between public access and private ownership, and it says a lot about the larger land use debates as well in the state. And you can read all about Liam Mayo's reporting on the Lackawaxen River, as well as his reporting on the ICE raid at the Elegante restaurant and the latest edition of the River Reporter, or their up-to-the-minute reporting at riverreporter.com. Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, another public use of land, but this time across the river in Sullivan County, without the tension, it appears. There's some momentum gathering for some new land use in Sullivan County on the O&W Rail Trail. We'll learn more after this. It's Radio Chatskill. Hi, I'm Tim Bruno, General Manager at Radio Catskill. This Thursday, it's NEPA Gives, and we need you to be a part of this 24-hour online giving event. Your donation helps keep trusted news, diverse voices, and local culture on the air for everyone. Now more than ever, your support makes a difference. Donate at NEPAGives.org starting at 7 Thursday. We're navigating uncertainty with the strength of our community behind us. Donate at NEPAGives.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we take you to a special kind of quinceañera, a doble quince, a double 15th, a 30th birthday party, when Frank Rojas celebrates his special queer day.
It's my family also seeing for the first time, like, my gay family.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Sullivan O&W Rail Trail, a multi-use trail system built along the historic Ontario and Western Railroad Corridor, is at the center of a regional initiative to connect communities, promote healthy lifestyles, and boost economic development through tourism. Joining us in the studio are two key figures in that effort. From Sullivan 180, Shannon Salento, Director of Community Development and Communications, and Heather Jaxie from Sullivan County's Director of Planning. Both are members of the Sullivan O&W Rail Trail Alliance, the coalition leading the charge on trail development across the county. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the big picture overview. What is the O&W Rail Trail and the Alliance's role in this development?
Yeah. So I'm going to turn that over to Heather, and but Sullivan 180 is happy to support it. And yeah, we're happy to be here.
Yeah. So the trail is at the end of the day going to be a 50-mile long trail through Sullivan County, Mamikating, Liberty, Fallsburg, Rockland, and a 10-mile spur from Monticello down to Port Jervis. There's an even bigger picture where OSI, Open Space Institute, is taking a look at the trail that goes from Port Jervis all the way up to Kingston. And, of course, that trail will link into the immense trail that New York State has been undertaking, the Empire State Trail, which goes all the way up to Canada and over to Buffalo from New York City. So,
and walk your way across the state and internationally, it seems, too. So why is this countywide trail system such a priority right now? And what are some of the social, environmental, economic benefits you hope to see?
Well, there's a ton.
Tell us.
Where to start.
Right. There are a lot of precedents that show that rail trails, especially ones that are sort of more regionally in length, you know, longer than 14 miles, so 50 miles would be great. They really do develop the economy around the trails, the property values, the health of the residents nearby, because having been a train, it could only go like 2% grade, so it's really set sort of like an easy, attainable, grade to ride your bike or to walk. It's like great if you're just learning or if you've got some disabilities.
In the previous segment, we were talking to Leah Mayo of the River Reporter about development of rail trails along the Lackawaxen River over there in the Wayne Pike area. A little bit of opposition and tension between public and private. Do you see that here, or is there a little bit more willingness for folks to be involved?
We've only met with open arms, but my understanding is that sometimes when rail trails are developed and some owners are worried about it, that they actually, at the end of the day, you know, they'll ask for fences or landscaping to barricade them off from it. And then, like, a year later, they'll, like, carve a gate into it. They'll really sort of embrace right, it once it's there.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Neversink Crossing Project. Let's talk about what's happening at that bridge over the Neversink River in Fallsburg. And why is that such a pivotal piece of the trail?
Because we have two chunks of trail that are already built with a river in the middle. So, in order to not go a 6 mile around bypass, we're building a bridge. There are a ton of partners. There's a lot of funding pots all going in. So it's a very complicated project. But at the end of the day, we're going to have a beautiful pedestrian bridge over the Neversink. And we'll have 14 miles of trail that will take you all the way from Mountaindale to Hurleyville and then through to Ferndale, really.
I was going to ask you about some of the challenges. It sounds like it was the river. What's the latest on the construction timeline there for that?
So a lot of the construction is underway right now. I feel like some of the really more difficult hurdles have been passed. We got the trees cleared before the bat window ended. And then some of the grading is going to take place. And the town of Fallsburg, who will be managing the construction, is currently negotiating a contract with Sullivan Paving.
Let's talk about the Rome multi-day trail hike that's coming up, and to get people invited to, you know, participate and learn more about these trails. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so I can speak to that a little bit. So Sullivan 180 has supported the Rome with a 2025 community development event grant. We're really excited. I think that's one of the reasons I love the program, is that we're able to support events like this that bring the community out. And maybe it's exposing people to the trail that haven't yet gone, because, you know, maybe you want the incentive of having a guided, you know, official walk to go on it and to experience it. So it's a different, you know, catch point for people. And I hope that we have new trail users. Heather, do you want to give some of the details of that event?
Sure. So it is this weekend. It's Saturday and Sunday. Saturday is kind of the longer walk, but you can join Nick Hovermail in the morning and go see all sorts of birds and walk from the Emma Chase School to Summitville. Or you can walk back from Summitville. The agenda is all online. If you Google Sullivan Rome, you can find it. And then Sunday, we have a shorter walk to from Emma Chase School to the Mamikating Environmental Education Center. And then from there, you can walk with Laura Silverman, who is the Outside Institute, a great naturalist very interesting. And she will lead a walk to the Bashkill Vineyard. We'll have a bunch of our partners out there at tables. The Bashkill Area Association is having a nature watch at the boat launch, which is right by the Bashkill Vineyard. And I believe that the Mamikaning Library is also having a story walk on Saturday. So there's tons of stuff. Explore the trails in Mamikaning. We are offering free lunch and free breakfast, but you do need to register. Otherwise, there will be not a sandwich for you.
Where can folks reserve their sandwich? Where can they get involved? Where can they learn more?
Yeah, if they just Google Sullivan Rome, they'll find it. We are living on the Sullivan Visitors Association website for registration and then through Eventbrite. But, you know, it's also on our website. We post on our Instagram and our Facebook all the time about things we're up to.
And also, you're looking for other community input in as part of the Sullivan County Bike and Pedestrian Master Plan. Talk a little bit about that plan and how it connects with the Rail Trail Project and how folks can get involved with taking that survey to help give their community input there.
Right. The survey will be up on the government website, the Sullivan County government website, probably by Friday. We want people to participate because we would like to see how we can better develop our network for people to walk and to bike, you know, how we can connect them better to their jobs and to places like parks and shopping and stuff like that.
And I mentioned you guys are with the O&W Rail Trail Alliance. Are there new trail segments or other partnerships in the pipeline, some things that you can preview here that are coming up?
Yes. So we have a lot of people working on trail segments. The town of Liberty has been working very hard to extend the Parksville section, extending it north towards the town of Rockland. And the town of Rockland is working very hard to connect their, well, they don't have the trail yet, but to create a trail from Livingston Manor south towards Parksville. So that's sort of the next section that will hopefully get completed.
And I think that's one of the really beautiful things about the Alliance in general is that it traverses many communities, and all of these communities in which the trail sits are really taking ownership of their segments and investing so much time and money into it. So it's really beautiful to see the community outreach and the community buy-in for this project.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's impressive. Like, it's over 30 miles of trail in our area, or is it more?
Well, right now there's 25, but we're hoping for 50 at the end of the day.
Right. I mean, even more amazing. Before we go, just anything else you'd like to share with the audience, or any favorite moments or big wins, or any sort of just like things that are getting you, you know, motivated to on this project?
I think the trail itself is motivation. It is really spectacular. If you've ever been out on any part of it, you know, each part has its own sort of character, and we're trying to brand it as a whole, but we really want to maintain those individual characters.
Shannon.
Yeah, I think, you know, at Sullivan 180, we work in the social determinants of health. So those things in the community that are complementary to healthcare, to traditional healthcare, and having access to a trail system to recreate, to exercise, to socialize is just such a community asset that we're so lucky to have here in Sullivan County. So it's just been an absolute joy to see it grow over the past, you know, I've only been here for 8 years, but to see just from where, even just 8 years ago to now, the development that's happened and the activation that's happening across these communities, that really the county and the Alliance have led is just, it's been nothing short of wonderful to watch. And I hope in a couple of years we're here again and we're able to say, look, we have, you know, we have all 50 miles. So
that would be great.
It's slow and steady, but it's exciting.
I want to put in a quick plug for the day pack. So if you don't feel comfortable because you don't know what to bring with you, you can go to your library and borrow a day pack. It has everything you'll need for a good day on the trail, except for water and snacks. You'll have to add those.
You have to reserve that sandwich, too, for that.
Exactly.
That's Shannon Salento. Well, that was Heather Jackson, Sullivan County's Director of Planning, and Shannon Salento, Director of Community Development and Communications at Sullivan 180. They are both members of the Sullivan O&W Rail Trail Alliance, the coalition leading the charge on trail development across the county. There's more about the O&W Rail Trail at SullivanONW.com, more about Sullivan 180 at Sullivan180.org, and more about the county government and all the stuff you're doing and planning there at SullivanNY.gov. Thank you guys so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Take a break. And when we come back, we'll find out how a small town in Delaware County became a book lover's paradise. It's the latest episode of Cat's Cast. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, would it help to think of failures on a spectrum?
I just went from the blameworthy end all the way over to the praiseworthy end.
And what about failures in medicine, where it truly can be life or death?
There's lots of examples of huge public sector failures, but this was one of the biggest.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
I'm Mimi Bradley, Radio Catskills Development Manager, reminding you that a great way to keep public radio here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania is by becoming a Sound Supporter. Sound Supporters give small amounts, $20, $30, $50 a month or more, that add up to a big help. Plus, Sound Supporters get special thank yous, like drawings for tickets to events in our community throughout the year. Become a Sound Supporter. Go to WJFFradio.org.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In the latest episode of Cat's Cast, producer Brett Berry sits down with Don Dales, the visionary behind one of the most unique literary transformations in upstate New York. What began as a single bookstore in the struggling village of Hobart has grown into the renowned Hobart Book Village, a cultural destination boasting 7 bookstores. And more. And to tell us more is Brett Berry from Cat's Cast. Brett, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little tongue-tied because of all these great things that are happening in Hobart. Let's first start out with Don Dales. Who is Don, and when did he come to Hobart?
Yeah, Don, he grew up in Stamford, which is just about 3 miles from Hobart. And he left, and then he came back for his 40th high school reunion and kind of rediscovered the place and moved back to Hobart, and which was at that time kind of, as he describes it, a bit of a ghost town. So that's where this story kind of picks up, and what he did to reinvigorate the village.
And I'm saying Hobart, but it's Hobart.
Yeah, you'll hear that. He'll correct both of us in the interview. So the locals know it as Hobart.
Hobart, got it. Well, in Hobart, he's created 7 bookstores, the Book Village Inn and Bar, beloved annual events. When did Hobart become Hobart Book Village?
Yeah, so he didn't create all of it, but he did. He was the impetus for this idea of creating a village around books, which comes from another village in Wales called Hay on Wye, which is a book village with maybe 20 or so bookstores. And so this idea was presented as a way to reinvigorate Hobart as a book village, starting with just one store. And that was enough of a spark for Don to say, hey, why don't we add more stores and just focus on books? And this would be a way to draw people to the town. And it seems to be working. It's celebrating its 20th anniversary as Hobart Book Village, as opposed to just Hobart.
Wow, and another name that's got a pronunciation issues. Hay on Wye, is that what you said in Wales?
Hay on Wye, yeah. Which I've never been to, but I had to look it up to make sure I was saying it correctly.
Well, very cool. We're going to hear your conversation with Don Dales and how they made Hobart into a must-visit haven for bibliophiles in the heart of Delaware County. Thank you so much, Brett.
Yeah, who knew, right?
Right?
Thanks, Tim.
My name is Don Dales. I live in Hobart, the book village of the Catskills, and have lived here for 25 years.
We met up with Don Dales at his home on Main Street in Hobart, New York. And that's Hobart, not Hobart.
Yes, we call it Hobart, with the accent on the first syllable. And, of course, newcomers call it Hobart, and I don't blame them.
And even though Don wasn't the first person to plant a bookshop in the village, he's credited with creating and branding Hobart Book Village, a destination for book lovers far and wide.
Yes, well, during the 1940s and 50s is when I grew up, and it was very different. At that time, the farming industry was the predominant industry, mostly cattle, but also chickens. And I grew up on a chicken farm. My father had chickens. So most of my fellow classmates in school were children of farmers, which always, in retrospect, strikes me a little funny because most of us were not rich. We were poor, and, you know, our houses did not have central heating, and most of us had plumbing. But none of us thought anything about it because we were all in the same boat. We didn't realize that other people lived differently. That was the area when I was growing up. It was pre-television, and I don't regret a moment of it.
And were the towns more vibrant then in terms of what was available and being able to kind of take care of all your needs right here locally?
Absolutely. Now, to be clear, I didn't grow up here in Hobart. I grew up in Stamford, which is 3 miles away. It's a slightly larger village. And yes, for the most part, we could get everything we needed in the village.
What happened? Why did it change and how did it change?
Well, big box stores primarily, and the easy access to cars and reliability of cars. People started going to Oneonta for their groceries because it was cheaper and more selection. The same thing with shoes and clothing. And so, of course, all the local stores went out of business.
And so when you came back, you had left the area for a while, and then you came back to Hobart. And can you tell me what the state of the town was?
It was pretty much a ghost village.
Yeah.
Well, there was a diner, the post office, and a pizza place, and that was pretty much it. All the other stores were vacant and very dilapidated, ugly looking and dirty, and it was pretty depressing, actually. And of course you say, well, why did you move back? And the truth was, I had no intention of moving back, but my 40th high school reunion came up, and an old high school friend called me. I had never gone to a reunion. And an old high school friend called and said, Donald, you've got to come to this one. It's your 40th year. So I said, okay. And I came up and I looked around and said, my God, this is the most beautiful place in the world. The Catskill Mountains and everything. Of course, when you're a kid, you don't see it. So anyway, I began to appreciate where I grew up. So I said, well, what the hell, I'll move to Hobart, which I did. For years, I had been renovating apartment houses and owned income property, so that was one of my goals, was to own something that would pay for itself in terms of rent.
And you bought some buildings here in town with the goal of?
Didn't really have much of a goal. They were dirt cheap because no one wanted them. And they all had apartments in them. And just to backtrack a little bit, in the past 40 years, a company had grown here in Hobart, Mallinckrodt, which is a drug manufacturing company, and they had grown to 600 employees. And I thought, well, at least I'll be able to rent apartments. So I bought several buildings. Coincidentally, they all had storefronts. Vacant storefronts. So I offered the storefronts free rent for a year with a business plan and had almost no takers. But also in the meantime, a storefront that I did not own, Bill and Diana Adams, by a fluke, showed up here and wanted to open an antiquarian bookstore. Now, they were busy in New York City. Bill was a physician, and Diana was a lawyer. But they wanted to open up an antiquarian bookstore on weekends, and so they rented this store from the owner at the time and opened up a bookstore, which I thought was the craziest idea in the world. Here we have an antiquarian bookstore in the middle of nowhere. Who's going to patronize it? But nonetheless, they did it, and they were charming people, and we became friends. There was also a bookstore about 4 miles from here in South Curry that was doing fairly well for itself. It was called Biblio Barn. Linda and HL, they owned it. And at one point, I was complaining to the Adams and to Linda and HL my difficulties renting the storefronts. And they asked me if I had ever heard of Heian Wai, which is a book town in Wales. It's a very big book town. It's got 20 or 30 bookstores in it. And I said, no. And so I Googled it and found out what it was. And I thought, well, geez, we got one bookstore. Let's try it. I like reading. I've always read, but not very seriously. So I'm not a book person, really. But I'm kind of used to business, and I'm not afraid of it. So I opened up two bookstores in two of my stores, and then before you know it, I enlarged one of them, and the other was taken over by someone who was interested in a bookstore. Then the one that I had enlarged was purchased by another person that wanted to own a local bookstore, and then things just began to roll along with people coming in and either buying or opening up their own bookstores. Now we have seven bookstores. We've never looked at it as competition. In fact, the village is very cooperative. We have monthly meetings, all the bookstore owners. We pool our marketing money to make a bigger impact. And we do try to keep the same hours. There are slight differences. They change during the winter. So be warned that we're only open on weekends during the winter, but from Memorial Day till Columbus Day, we are open every day of the week. We have the Festival of Women's Writers every year. That is done by the two ladies that have the Blenheim Hill Books, Barbara and Cheryl. And that's a wonderful event. It takes place in June. They have readings, they have receptions for the attendees and for the authors. They have seminars, and everyone that I've heard that has attended it has been so pleased with it. So it's a lot of fun. It's very educational. You meet some well-known authors, and maybe you'll learn something.
You've been featured in the New York Times, The Guardian, CBS Sunday Morning. Have you seen an impact from that in terms of the people coming up here?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a tremendous impact. One of the biggest impacts was a small piece in TikTok that a young lady put on TikTok.
That is filled entirely with bookstores.
And it's every book lover's dream.
It's called Hobart Book Village.
There's even a
I don't have a cell phone, so I wasn't able to see it, but apparently it wasn't very long. But my goodness, the impact that made was absolutely tremendous. Not to say that CBS and the rest of them didn't have impact. They had a large impact, too. So we can hope that that sort of thing will continue.
You're an influencer, Don.
Oh, yeah, right. I barely know how to get on Facebook. I think one of the things to understand is that a lot of the people that came to visit the Book Village, they usually do some other things in the Catskills, food and lodging. And then they find out maybe about the Arkville Railroad or Hanford Mills Museum or some other place. So they may come for the Book Village, but they spend their money in the Catskills, which I've often said that our goal is to bring people here and empty their pockets. We're doing the best we can.
So how have you seen activity change in the past 20 years in this town from that kind of dismal scene that you painted at the beginning of this conversation where it was kind of a ghost town? Has it revived to a point that you feel there's life and energy here?
Absolutely. I mean, it's obvious that the bookstores bring a certain amount of life and energy, and on, mostly on weekends you can see the number of cars and people walking up and down the streets, which is really nice. The number of people that have moved here, especially during the 2008 recession, to get away from New York City. And then the reason they bought in Hobart or near Hobart was because of the Book Village. And we're talking about a demographic that is affluent and well-educated. I mean, they came because of the Book Village. So it's had quite an effect on the area.
And do you still own a bookstore here in town?
Not any longer. Up until last year, I did own a bookstore, Mysteries and Science Fiction. But I finally, since I have reached advanced old age, I've decided to retire. I got rid of all the apartment houses. I got rid of the restoration business and the bookstore. And I'm finally well over 80, and I'm retired.
So how do you spend your time now?
Practicing the piano, and I do have a shop downstairs, and I restore my own furniture. I've got a mess of broken furniture throughout the years I've gathered, and so I work on that. And, you know, goof off. What the heck?
How would you define your role in the establishment of the Book Village?
Lucky. I'm not sure there was much intent involved in the whole thing. I mean, I enjoyed establishing the bookstores, and I enjoyed owning a bookstore all those years. As I said, I'm a casual reader, mostly of mysteries and sci-fi. So that was kind of fun. And of course, it was fun having bookstore owners to work with. They're a well-educated group of people, and that's stimulating. I didn't really see it all happening. It was only semi-intentional, but it certainly was lucky.
More information on Hobart and its bookshops at hobartbookvillage.com. The 2025 Hobart Festival of Women Writers Festival takes place June 6th, 7th, and 8th. More at hobartfestivalofwomenwriters.blog. For CatsCast and WJFF Radio Catskill, this is Brett Berry.
And there's more information in that whole episode, as well as recent episodes of CatsCast, at their website, catscast.com. CatsCast is the biweekly series featuring Catskills culture, history, sustainability, local interviews, and more. All shows are hosted and produced by Brett Berry at Silver Hollow Audio in the heart of the Catskills, and they've been voted best regional podcast 3 years in a row, and you can hear why. Before we go, a reminder that our 35th anniversary t-shirt design contest is wrapping up this Friday. The deadline for entries is Friday the 6th, and we need to have some more artists to bring us their work to showcase on the t-shirts worn by listeners, supporters, and fellow public radio lovers. We are celebrating our 35th anniversary with your work. Again, that original line-based artwork deadline is June 6th, and that should reflect the spirit of Radio Catskill and 35 years of public radio. All the official rules and guidelines are at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent, grassroots, global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Abundant sunshine today with a high of 79 might be a little hazy due to some wildfire smoke from Canada. Tonight, a low 55. Warmer tomorrow, sunny 87, 87 for Thursday as well. Scattered thunderstorms and rain back in the forecast Friday and Saturday, but partly cloudy, 73 Sunday. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.